All right, so we're going to call the House Finance Committee to order. The time is about 1:40. For the record, we have Representative Moses, Representative Holm, Representative Kelly, Representative Foster, Co-Chair Representative Schnell, Vice Chair Representative Stokes, Representative Hawker, Representative Wyrock, and let's see, I've seen Representative Julie, he's not here yet, and Representative Croft is excused. Okay, so on today's calendar, we will go ahead and take back up House Bill 46, the Water, Sewer, Waste Grants to Utilities, which we heard last week, and brought forward a new CS on that. And then after that, we'll take up House Bill 76, Big Game and Commercial Services Board. We'll take a brief at ease after we do House Bill 46 so that we can get the sponsor for House Bill 76 up here. Apparently, he's in our sharing the resources committee. So, is there anything to come before the
movie?
No, not yet.
Oh. Down, boy, down.
Not a bad idea.
We have to adopt the CS first.
Okay, let's see. Oh, Mr. Wright, you're representing the Speaker Harris on this. You might come forward. Before the committee, we have a blank committee substitute. Let's see, what is it? Work draft number 24LS0393Y Craver. So I'd like to have a motion to bring that before us as our working document.
I move.
Okay. Any objection? Seeing none? We now have that CS before us. There were two amendments that were incorporated. One amendment clarifies that utilities are owned or operated by a political subdivision of the state, that is, a municipality, is eligible for these grants. That was amended over in the Senate resources. And then that amendment also provides that any grant to a public utility that is not owned or operated by a municipality must be repaid in full if the utility is sold and the utility ceases to be regulated by RCA. The second amendment was by Representative Croft, and that dealt with private-owned utilities. Let's see, the second amendment was incorporated by Representative Croft to deal with his concern that privately-owned utilities did not receive capital gains due to a grant that was administered by the state. Okay, I want to welcome Representative Jewell. Mr. Wright, have you had a chance to review these amendments and CS, and what's your thoughts?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Tom Wright, staff through Speaker John Harris. We have no objection to the amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Questions, Stokes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Wright, I'm trying to find my old copy. Is the language on page 2, lines 26 through 28, is that new language that's slipped by somehow?
That is amendment.
Mr. Chairman, that was language that was in the Croft amendment. It was modified slightly, noted for something the drafters thought. Note: this is the way it should read. So it is a little bit different, I believe, than the original amendment.
Okay.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And yes, this language here is very similar to language that I had spent some time discussing with Representative Croft. What I was wondering, and I don't know, is Representative Croft attending by teleconference, Mr. Chairman?
Is he online? No, he's not.
In this language, the whole idea here is to protect a state investment, a public investment in a utility that is regulated by the RCA from being essentially that benefit accruing to a non-regulated utility through the sale of that utility. And this language provides that if a public utility is sold within 10 years of receiving a grant and, a key point, and ceases to be regulated, that grant has to be repaid. And I was just only querying if 10 years is not a bit of a long window here. 10 years is almost, forever in the lifetime of the sort of grants we're talking about here. These are not mega capital grants. These are much smaller, you know, investing in pieces that are assets and investments that, quite frankly, I'm not so sure they've got a 10-year lifespan. I did, and at the risk of speaking for Representative Croft, who is not here, I did speak with his aide, who indicated that that number was not a terribly at issue point with the representative. But I hesitate to, I don't want to put the words in his mouth, but I think I'd like to see that move to 5 years, and I'd be curious what the committee's thoughts might be.
Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be a positive move. I had a difficulty with the entire addition from the standpoint of this ends up benefiting the public by using matching grant method to make a line extension, basically. And if, in fact, the owners have conditions that are too unreasonable, then maybe that extension doesn't get made and the good thing doesn't happen. So I think moving it to 5 years probably makes it more acceptable, and I would support that.
Motion?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I would move that on the CS, and again, with apologies that it's not written here, but I would move that on line 24, page 2 of the CS, that 10 be replaced with 5.
Okay, and I'll object so we can discuss this in a little more detail. We do have Representative Croft online now in Anchorage. Representative Croft, have you had an opportunity to hear the amendment?
Yeah, just, but go ahead and I can catch up in the discussion.
I'm sorry, you have or you have not heard the amendment that Representative Hawker is proposing?
Yeah, I heard the amendment, Mr. Chairman, and look forward to the discussion to explain it a little, but so I understand what he's doing. I don't yet understand why.
Representative Hawker, go ahead.
I'm very happy to have Representative Croft on board here, repeating basically what I brought forward as the question. You know, obviously this language does provide assurance to us as custodians of the public trust that public money that goes to benefit a utility that is in fact regulated, subject to regulated rates, that value does not ultimately get transferred in some manner or fashion to a non-regulated utility, that the language works very well. I was only questioning whether 10 years is an appropriate restriction on requiring full repayment, considering the type of grants that are involved here, and very much I would pirate some of the argument from Representative Kelly that, you know, in fact, no matter how these grants, no matter who the recipient is, these grants are benefiting the public in one manner, fashion, or another. And I was suggesting that 5 years would make me more comfortable than putting a 10-year cloud on the operations of a utility company.
Representative Croft, do you have a response?
Well, that's fine with me, Mr. Chairman. To some extent, 5 or 10 years hadn't been the result of any study or scientific analysis. They'd just been some estimates. And I do think there's a practical difficulty in keeping this on in books with an asterisk, if you will, for too long. As long as we're pursuing this intent that it not be a state grant that goes very quickly to individual private gain, and I think either 5 or 10 keeps that concept fine. So it's your CS. It was my amendment. I think 5 would be fine with me.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Representative Croft. Representative Stoltz.
Oh, I was going to debate it, but Mr. Croft started with 10, and Mr. Kelly wanted 0, and if you can get walk away with 5 and get half of what you wanted from a Fairbanks guy, it's a victory, and go home.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Stoltz. Representative Weber.
The context, though, of the language is a grant must be repaid in full by a public utility that is not owned or operated by a municipality if the public utility is sold within 5 years after receiving the grant. Aren't we really talking about if the public utility is sold to a non-regulated utility within 5 years?
Uh, your question to Representative.
Well, the maker of the, I mean, it's really to the maker of the motion, 5 years.
And I believe, is that not accomplished with the conjunctive and the qualification being imposed on the buying entity that the and that the rates of the entity buying the subsection are not regulated, so it would only be effective if we sold to a non-regulated utility.
Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
What's the historic precedent for doing that in the state? Who would have information on that where a public utility is sold? When does that ever happen? Maybe the sponsor knows.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know.
It just seems it's hedging a risk that may not ever occur. So.
Okay. Representative Weirich, we do have Mr. Easton here with the DEC, and we also have Jim Strandberg with the RCA, and James Keene with the RCA. So I don't know, anybody comfortable answering that question on Representative Weirich's?
Well, I always trust Mr. Easton.
Mr. Easton? Okay. Please join us, Mr. Easton. For the record, give it your name and practice.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Dan Easton, Director of the Division of Water for the Department of Environmental Conservation. And I must not have shaken my head no loudly enough, because I'm really not able to answer that specific question. But Commissioner Strandberg, if he's online, may be able to answer that.
Yes, I am here.
You want to take a shot at that, Mr. Strandberg?
Yes. You know, I...
Can you give us your name and title, please, for the record?
Surely. I am Jim Strandberg, one of the RCA commissioners. Let's see. The question, Mr. Chair, was, is there any data on how often utilities change hands in response to this hypothetical situation that the amendment is concerned with? I've been with the commission now for almost 6 years, and we've processed quite a number of ownership changes in small utilities. As to whether it's 5, 10, 15, or 20, I can't give you definitive data. My feeling is in the last 6 years, surely it has been under 20 utilities, and that is an educated guess on my part. The one point of interest to you is that certificated transfer of certificates will almost always come before the RCA, if the utility is a falls under the definition of a public utility, and I'll comment that that's very broad. As to the question of whether or not we economically regulate, that's a separate question, and I would say that we monitor the current ownership of certificated utilities. They are required to approach us with any transfers. We have many, many more certificated utilities than we have utilities that we economically regulate. And I hope that's helpful.
Mr. Chairman,
sure.
I guess then the RCA or whatever successor entity would exist to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska would look at the formation of a public utility formed 5 years after a grant that's the transferee of one of these askance as not so that the RCA would not be involved in allowing a sham transaction to occur just to avoid repayment. Would that be the RCA's position on that?
Yes. We want to maintain a an ownership that is fit, willing, and able. That is our definition under our statute. But I would comment that for unregulated, for utilities we do not economically regulate, we will not set their rates. So the question of whether an acquisition adjustment would be included in the rates or would not be included in the rates, we would only be able to assure that under the utilities that we economically regulate, which is a relatively small subset.
Mr. Chairman?
Just one, please. Rich Navarro, did you have a follow-up to it? Okay, thank you. Yes, who's speaking?
This is Representative Croft.
Oh, okay.
And I think that's the point, that a lot of the bases for the, there's a lot of concern in the committee and elsewhere that the state grant might end up as solely a private benefit. And one of the assurances we had in the letter that's in the file from the RCA was that as long as the RCA economically regulated them, they would restrict the rates that could be charged, and they would not allow the grant, whatever the grant funded, to be part of the base for cost recovery. And because the price you're going to pay for a utility is dependent primarily on the rates you can charge, if I'm a private buyer, I'm only going to pay something that approximates, you know, the what I'm able to charge in the future. That our main comfort level that it would not be sort of a extra benefit to a private entity was that economic regulation by the RCA. And I guess I want to ask now from the RCA representative, does the language that we're proposing in that amendment assure that? That is either, getting out of RCA economic regulation is the triggering mechanism for a potential payback under the amendment.
Commissioner, did you hear the question by Representative Croft?
Yes, this is Jim Strandberg. Through the chair, Representative Croft, I believe that language will accomplish that. I would comment that requiring a repayment of a grant as a condition of sale could fairly under certain circumstances affect the feasibility of actually accomplishing the commercial agreement.
Representative
Prop? Well, I guess in that limited situation, and I doubt they'll be very frequent, but I would expect it to, and it would be the purpose of the amendment that it would affect the economics of it, that you wouldn't be able to get that kind of bonus, and paying it back would change the economics. I don't know how frequent it will be, but that's the very thing it's intended to do, I think.
And in response, yes, Representative Croft, I just offer that comment just on a quiet reflection on my part. But I would believe that particular amendment would prevent any private enrichment as a result of that grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Croft. Mr. Strandberg, if you can stay with us here for a bit. Representative Stoltz has a question.
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It may not be for Mr. Strandberg. I'm trying to muddle through this here, and it's provides that a public utility can be transferred and they can still accrue the benefit. Is there any public interest? You know, we've been talking about things like Anwar and wanting to have our local hire things. Is there any interest in, say, limiting it to state-owned based businesses or no foreign-owned? Or, I mean, I guess I'm trying to fully understand all the implications.
For me.
That's for anybody, I guess. I don't, the people carrying the bill, Mr. Harris's office, I don't know. Fairbanks guys.
Mr. Strandberg, did you want to take a shot at that? I don't see any volunteers here.
Yes. Let me see. I'm through the chair, Representative Stoltz, I'm not sure I understand the question. Could you please repeat that for me?
Well, and I'm probably muddling through developing the question, and that's that we're allowing a utility that to receive this state grant. Is there any benefit from the public policy perspective about not allowing, say, foreign-owned companies to might have buying up utilities around the country and coming into Alaska? I don't know. It's I'm just trying to think of hypotheticals here, trying to.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, I don't, you know, any sort of prohibition, we would have to look at our statute on that, and presently I don't know of any foreign-owned utilities, and I'm not sure that we have any statutory authority to differentiate with respect to the actual ownership of the utility.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, you know, I'm certainly don't, I think I get the gist of Representative Stoltz's questions. All these utilities still are regulated, you know, have to be regulated by the RCA, you know, if a repayment plan is not going to be made. I guess I'm kind of reversing that a little bit. But all these utilities who are receiving the grant, if they are to be sold to a public utility, that grant is still in effect as long as that the new owners are regulated, whether they're foreign or whether they're, if they are foreign or they are not regulated, then they have to repay the grant within 5 years. That's the way I understand it. That probably muddied up the situation even worse.
Well, I think add that fact that foreign or not, they'd have to be regulated for protection to the fact that the matching grant, of which a foreign corporation would have to come up with half and the this program with half, is still driving down to the benefit of the consumer. So I think we're okay there on how it touches down. I don't see how the ownership of it could hurt what benefit the program does or lessen the control of RCA to make sure that it doesn't aggrandize the private corporation.
Gentlemen, Mr. Chair, this is Jim Strandberg. If I could just make one comment.
Sure.
Perhaps we could look at the way things are working now. Literally any privately owned, investor-owned utility will be subject to our regulation now. Unless the legislature changes this, the likelihood of an investor-owned utility going into an unregulated status is very unlikely. I guess I'm just trying to understand what the scenario would be where a utility could go, an investor-owned or a privately owned utility could actually go into unregulated status. And I'm not seeing it right now in our in neither our rules nor our statute.
Okay, follow-up.
Thank you, Chairman Meyer. Last year there was legislation that removed RCA regulation of certain utilities, and when it came through the House, and I think cooler heads prevailed in the Senate, and I think it's been reintroduced again. So I guess that's one thing that it's rearing its head, and it may not be fair to ask how one bill affects the other, bills that haven't passed, but presuming the hypotheticals, both those bills pass, you know, how what protections do we have? Because that would potentially eliminate the RCA regulation, notwithstanding these stipulations.
Mr. Chair, this is Jim Strandberg. May I reply to Representative Stoltz?
Yes, go ahead.
That I would note that AWWU bill, which is back again, that is a deregulation of a municipally owned utility. And I think that is a somewhat special case of a large municipally owned utility. I know of no other major action for a major privately owned investor-owned utility to be deregulated. Now, if I might ask, is that what you're alluding to? Is the fact is a possible scenario where that might occur?
Mr. Chairman, just one possible scenario, and that's just in the version it is now. I don't know what things look like when they get through this process either. So,
yes, sir.
it's only paranoid if they're out to, not paranoia if they're out to get you, right?
We're here to serve.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might respond to Representative Stoltz's remarks, it is not our intent to get in this bill in any way involved in that legislation. We want this to be a standalone bill, and if it does look like it's heading that way, we will certainly be objecting to that.
I appreciate that, and that full confidence in Mr. Wright and his office.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wright. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It occurs to me that we may, by this payback provision, have some unintended consequences, and I might offer that the benefits accrued by a municipality-owned utility by selling it to a for-profit, if you will, corporation, may in fact bail out the municipality. And in the case of the city of Fairbanks, I think in fact that's exactly what did happen. And because of that, if the payback provisions are onerous or if they're huge, we may have the unintended consequence that some municipally owned facilities may be forced to go bankrupt underneath these provisions of payback. So I don't know how far down this road we want to go, but you know, it seems to me that if you have a municipality getting money from this program, everybody in the area is benefiting by it anyway. So I'm not sure that we're really gaining anything by having this payback provision.
My car's pulled over to the side. I'm just waiting.
Yeah.
I'm not going down there.
Great. All right. Thank you, Mr. Strandberg, Mr. Wright. I'm going to remove my objection to the amendment, and unless anyone else has an objection to it, it will be incorporated. Just one other issue, Mr. Easton, please stay. We did zero out the fiscal note on this bill, and would like to get your thoughts and comments about that. I think Representative Hawker brought this up, and I agreed with him, but I'd like to get your opinion.
Mr. Chairman, unless you want me to, I won't go back through the basis for the fiscal note. Obviously, we saw a shift in an increase in our work as we shifted from making a small number of large grants to very competent, well-trained municipalities with public works departments and administrative staff to making a larger number of smaller grants to much smaller and sort of less sophisticated utilities. And that was the basis for the, generally the basis for the fiscal note. We obviously anticipate a workload impact. If there is a zero fiscal note, we'll contend with that as best we can.
Very good.
Is there a motion to adopt the zero fiscal note?
Just a minute. The Representative Schnell.
And I guess, you know, we talked about, and I did look at the fiscal note. We talked about it last week. I see in 03 that you were associated with 32 matching grants. In 04, you were associated with 12. And in 05, 7. This is the sheet. And my question is, because I haven't went back and researched it, would simply be, I believe you have the same amount of employees in 03 as you have in 05. And if that is indeed the case, it looks like to me that we went the opposite direction, but yet we've kept the same amount of staffing, and to me it seems like that it's the right thing to do to zero out the fiscal note, simply because it appears to me that your workload's actually gotten smaller than it was 2 years ago. So I do agree with Representative Hawker's reasons to lower the or to zero out the fiscal note, and Okay,
thank you, Representative Chenault. I don't think we need a motion to adopt this one. We'll just make sure it's adopted with the CS as it's moved out of committee. President Foster. Okay, any other discussion about the CS or the fiscal note or the bill in general? Seeing none, go ahead, Representative Foster.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and move out 1846, committee substitute. What the fiscal note has discussed.
As amended.
As amended.
No, it was the CS, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. It was the CS. Sorry, you're right. So you moved the CS with the attached fiscal note out of the committee. Okay. Any objections?
As amended.
Sorry?
As amended.
Yes, I'm sorry. As amended. It was amended. Okay, let's try this again. You're moving CS, House Bill 46, as amended. With the attached fiscal note. Okay. We okay on that? Okay. No objections, and that is done. Thank you.
Thank you.
I forgot everything. Let's go ahead and take a brief at Easter while we change topics for this. Okay, we're going to come back to order. House Finance Committee. Next item for discussion is House Bill 76, Big Game Services and Commercial Services Board, by Representative Samuels. And it looks like Representative Samuels, there are several people also online and some in the audience here for teleconference. So why don't you go ahead, Representative Samuels, and tell us what your bill is about.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. HB 76 reestablishes the Big Games Commercial Services Board. And in the previous legislature, I was the chairman of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. And as the chairman of that committee, I reviewed several of the audits that came through, and one of them, mostly for reasons of consumer protection, was their point, said there was a big problem by not having a board, a customer of a guy that felt they were treated poorly had really nowhere to go. And when the board sunsetted in 1994, the duties of the board went to the Division of Auct Licensing, which I think they do a good job, but they're not very specialized. And it created some problems. And Pat Davidson, I believe, is here that can talk about the specifics of the audit. The board would oversee the professional hunting and transporting industry, which I believe is about $100 million a year industry in the state of Alaska. And the bill, without going into the actual line by line, mostly what it does is it's taking the duties away from Auct Licensing and giving them to the board, which is why it's a 30-page bill. It takes the duties itself aren't changing that much. Last year, this made it through quite an extensive hearing process in the other body, and a whole lot of work has gone in there to reach compromises between the hunters. The auditor was involved, Fish and Game was involved, DNR was involved, and we spent a tremendous amount of time trying to work out the specifics of the bill. And if you've got any questions, I'd kind of like to wait until after Pat Davidson testifies and Fish and Game comes up and testifies, and they can kind of outline some of the problems they see and some of the necessities that they see for the bill. So with that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Representative Samuels. Okay, let's go ahead and go to Ms. Davidson then. Okay, you can state the questions. Very good, for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the record. My name is Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit. We did an audit that had three main goals as its purposes. The first was to determine the impact that the absence of a professional licensing board for guides and transporters had on the enforcement of guiding statutes, look at the appropriateness of the fines and other enforcement mechanisms, and determine the adequacy of the reporting, the current reporting requirements for transporters. With the termination of the Big Game Commercial Services Board, there's been little or no professional oversight of licensed guides and transporters. Any monitoring of guide and transporting activities was done primarily by the various land managers in the state, such as the National Park Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, U.S. Forest Service, the BLM, and the state's DNR Division, Mining, Land, and Water. These agencies said that they would welcome a more vigorous, centralized licensing regulatory board to oversee transporters and, to a lesser extent, guides. When the Big Game Commercial Services Board sunset, many of the consumer protection or best practices statutes and regulations were also eliminated. Guiding activity contributes conservatively tens of millions of dollars to the state's economy every year. During the audit, we conducted a survey of clients. And during that survey, the clients indicated, pretty much they indicated a positive hunting experience. Some did report dissatisfaction, and the key concern of that dissatisfaction, other than an unsuccessful hunt, was consumer protection issues. Based on our review, we can conclude that statutory changes to include best practices is warranted. These type of changes would provide important consumer protection and hunter safety elements. While the reestablishment of a guide board is not essential to making these statutory improvements, a reestablished board is likely to provide a more dynamic regulatory regime for this profession, allowing regulations to be updated and enhanced on a regular basis, that would provide an enhancement to the professionalism of guides and maintain consumer protection and provide for hunter safety. If the legislature does consider reestablishing the board, we believe that the board should be limited to setting the minimum competency requirements for licensure, working with occupational licensing to enforce statutory and regulatory requirements for these licensees. And finally, we concluded that the current reporting requirements for transporters was adequate.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Davidson. Any questions for Ms. Davidson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think there's probably a lot of merit to the bill, but 10 years ago, the legislature directed a bureaucracy to perform a function, i.e. the occupational licensing. Do you feel that that agency actually made a good faith effort or didn't want to do it and let it slide? I don't want to reward bad behavior because they don't want to do a function, and that's, I heard some of those complaints. What's your take on that as a third party that has looked at this more times than you probably cared to?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, I'd say that the comments that I'm about to make are more...
Be as subjective as you want. I don't care.
Are more a result of doing sunset audits on various boards and commissions, you know, over the last 10, 15, 20 years. And I would say that one of the things that we see with boards, as opposed to regulations or activities that are being regulated by the division without boards, there are more active updates in regulations, in responding to changes in the profession. Those happen on a regular basis with boards. We don't see those happening typically when there's not a board. So I don't know that the division particularly didn't like dealing with these. They just don't deal with, there's nobody to screen, basically, when the division isn't doing and keeping up on these.
So, Mr. Chairman, they made their best faith effort to make this work, and it's just untenable there? I'm trying to, I'll let you answer. I don't not have me.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, we did not try to analyze what the division did or didn't do. What we know is that there was nothing in statute or regulations. There didn't seem to be any attempt by the department or the division to introduce legislation to address issues such as best practices for that type of thing. One of the key best practices is having a written contract. I mean, if you're going to lay out tens of thousands of dollars to go on a hunt and you have no written contract, and there's no required written contract between the client and the guide, then the division may try to have their investigators go out and investigate a complaint, but you have no basis to use criteria to say that the hunt wasn't done as contracted for, because there's nothing in writing.
Chairman, no, and I appreciate that. I just know the sponsor of the bill. It's big government is an anathema to him, and he's just not gratuitously offering more regulation, and that there's he's trying to address serious needs. So I was just trying to probe the history, just to educate myself.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Stoltz. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Davidson. I think at this time, then, we'll go on and take public testimony. I have Matt Robus, the Director of Division of Wildlife Conservation. Welcome, Mr. Robus.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Matt Robus. I'm the Director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation within the Department of Fish and Game. And I'll state at the outset that while I have participated over the last year in working out the details of the present bill through kind of a committee process between different agencies and different proponents and advocates. I don't have the best detailed knowledge of the bill, and I'm used to testifying behind some of the people who will come behind me, and I may defer some detailed questions to them with your permission. I'm here to testify in support of the bill. The Department of Fish and Game and the Board of Game are both on record several times over the past, the interim since the board went away the last time, as believing that a new Big Game Commercial Services Board would be of substantial aid in proper management of commercial uses and how that affects management of wildlife in the state. The state really does need to have some control over the commercial uses of wildlife, and while it did reside, this partially answers Representative Stoltz's question a moment ago, it did reside in a department. However, it's been pointed out to me that a board allows all of the industry to come together through a public process to work on promulgating new regulations and changing industry standards and so forth, whereas when it control resides within a department, you have access, but it tends not to be in that centralized open format quite so much. The Department of Fish and Game provides wildlife resource information and expertise to the Board of Game, and the Board of Game makes most of the wildlife regulations in the state, and that's what we tend to think of as wildlife management. However, wildlife management has both a biological component and a people component, people use component. And beyond setting bag limits and seasoning dates, the Board of Game is really not equipped with very many tools to address different types of user conflicts until you go to fairly high-profile draconian measures like controlled use areas and restrictions and the like. And both the department and the board in the past have gotten into some extremely convoluted attempts to try to write regulations that would solve a human user group conflict when biology wasn't really all that concerned. And in most of those cases, the board has finally backed off and said, you know, this is not an appropriate way to try to indirectly manage the way that the commercial and private users use the resource. And so it's the department's belief that a Big Game Commercial Services Board, with its jurisdiction over a part of wildlife management, the people part, the commercial people part, would mesh very nicely with the ability that the Board of Game has to manage the biological side of things and seasons and bag limits and so forth, methods and means. So, with those general remarks, I'll say that we believe that the board represents a good compromise to get a board started and then hopefully see regulations over time that would home in on some of these conflict problems that we've been struggling with. It is true that both the Board of Game and the department feel that the transporter segment of the industry is really needs to be addressed. And while it takes a little bit lesser profile in this bill, I've been told, and I see in the bill, how the authority is vested in this board to work on that in the future, so both the guiding industry and the transporter industry can be regulated appropriately. So with that, I'll finish, and I would be happy to try to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We do have a question, Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's probably a real quick one here. In Section 6, it says, subsection RJ, violation of a state or federal hunting. And that, are there any examples of federal law or regulation that are real inconsistent with state law that might be, I don't know, I just don't know a lot about, and there's certainly controversy in some of the federal regulations and statutes. I'm just really searching to make sure that we're not endorsing something that might be have more onerous provisions that wouldn't even be dreamed to be in a state violation.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, I'm going to answer this in a general way because I can't give you any detailed examples, but the federal government has jurisdiction within some of the conservation system units, refuges and park preserves and so forth. And there is guiding allowed in at least certain parts of refuges and preserves, and there are rules there imposed by the federal government that are not imposed by the state, and therefore, I can think of federal rules there that could be violated that would not be the same thing as the state. And then, of course, there are federal wildlife violations even on state-managed land. For instance, taking illegal wildlife across state boundaries can wind up with a federal violation. So there's a layering, I guess you'd say, of state wildlife law and federal wildlife law, and it varies depending on what piece of ground you're on in the state.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stoltz. Thank you, Mr. Robles. I don't see any questions for your testimony. Oh, got one? Quick. Mr. St. Kelly?
Perhaps maybe to the sponsor, maybe not to...
Okay, well, we'll bring the sponsor back up. Yeah. He's not going anymore. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. All right, let's see. Rick Thompson, Division of Mining and Land and Water. Are you with us via teleconference?
I am, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. For the record, my name is Rick Thompson. I am a regional manager here in South Central Alaska for the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, and I'm speaking for the Department of Natural Resources. And I just want to add our support for the bill in the management of public lands. We think that this gives us a tool to help us do our job more efficiently, and our experience with it in the past has been a positive thing. So that's all I have to say, and I'm happy to answer any questions I can.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Thompson. I don't see any questions. Thank you very much. Okay, we'll go on to Joe Plechich. Is that correct? On teleconference?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it's Joe Clutch. I'm calling you from King Salmon out here on a snowy, cold Bristol Bay afternoon. There's no global warming here, and I just want to add this little preface to my testimony. My kid has been trapping some beavers out here, and he left a carcass on the back porch, and I'm not making this up. I'm looking out the window now at two bald eagles at less than 15 yards away, and they're looking in the window at me while I give this testimony. I've got to say I'm more comfortable with them looking at me than you looking at me.
Yeah.
So. Anyway, I've lived out here 35 years. I'm president of Alaska Professional Hunters Association. We have 160 professional members and 500 sustaining, 120 life. And we represent a complete cross-section of all types and scales of and areas of operation throughout the state. A vast majority of our members are family people with small businesses. And we've been down a long trail in our efforts to establish a board or a regulatory entity that oversees the activities of hunting guides and transporters. This has been going on for, almost two decades. What we know is that without proper regulation, the wildlife populations suffer, and the people who rely on those resources suffer. They suffer loss of opportunity, and they suffer quality of experience. That's just not guides and transporters. That's general residents. That's subsistence users. That's everybody that relies on the resource. As mentioned earlier, and I'll make this as brief as I can and not redundant, but the guiding component of the commercial service industry facilitates up to $200 million annually of private sector funds to our state. A large portion of that in the license and tag fees goes to the Department of Fish and Game, which they desperately need to do proper surveys and carry out their management functions. The state just, we can't afford to forfeit this contribution, both to our families and to the economy of the state in general. Now, one of the committee members posed a question earlier. Why would a private sector entity come out in favor of establishing additional state oversight and an additional regulatory board. That's just almost inconsistent with private sector thinking. As guides and transporters, we're subject to statutes and regulations for any or sometimes all of the following agencies. Consider this: the Department of Commerce and Economic Development, the Department of Environmental Conservation, the Department of Natural Resources, multiple divisions, including land, mining, and water, and the Division of State Parks, the Department of Fish and Game, the Board of Game, the Department of Public Safety, the National Park Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. Forest Service, BLM, private landowners, the U.S. Coast Guard, the FAA, the FCC, statutes and regulations and rulemaking coming out of Congress, and your activities there in the legislature. That's a lot of stuff coming at us. And what this thing has evolved into in the last 4 or 5 years is that we have a basic disconnect, and it's understandable. I'm not faulting any of the above agencies that I've mentioned, but there's a disconnect between what everybody's doing, what their mission assignments are, what their regulatory schemes are, what their jurisdiction is, and how to have something comprehensive that works for everybody involved. That's the purpose of this board, in my thinking, and I've lived through boards for 25 years. Essentially, it boils down to this. You can have all the key players in the same room at the same time, including the affected parties in the industry, the guides, the assistant guides, the transporters, other general members of the public. They can all come in and express their concerns, their views, their recommendations, and all these people hear it at one time. They walk out of the room, they can have subcommittee meetings, they can coordinate, and you get something that's comprehensive and works for everybody. We're just really suffering from a disconnect right now. And as a consequence, the resource is suffering. And this isn't that complicated of a deal. It really isn't. Let us get on with our business and work with the respective agencies, and I know we can make this work. We're capable of doing that, and we have the commitment of the agencies that I've mentioned. So I'm going to urge the committee to move this bill out, and you can know that our association will work with you and the legislature in every way possible to craft this legislation in the right way. It's just really critically important at this juncture for us. Another two-year wait. Things are slipping away, folks. We've got to keep this private sector component of Alaska's economy in intact and protect the wildlife resources at the same time. And I'll conclude my remarks with that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Clutch, for that testimony. Hopefully the eagles are still there for you to enjoy. We haven't scared them off. Is there any?
No, in fact, they are. They're looking at me right now.
Very good.
They're sure to be with that.
That's right. Okay, there's no questions. Thank you for your testimony, sir. All right, we'll go on to Mr. Fithian.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, board members. In view of time and similar testimonies, I just want to allow my testimony with that you just heard of Mr. Clutch's. And I represent the Alaska Professional Hunters Association as their executive director, and without any hesitation, I know that our members are in total support of this bill and that we ask you to move it. And I thank you for the time to testify today.
All right. Well, thank you for your testimony. For the record, though, could we get your name again, please?
This is Bobby Fithian, F-I-T-H-I-A-N.
Very good. I'm
calling from Lower Tanzina.
All right, thank you. Thank you for calling in today. We'll go on to Kim Franklin in Kotzebue.
Hello. Hello, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
My name is Franklin, and I work for the Northwest Arctic Borough Planning Department. The borough's boundaries encompass an area of approximately 39,000 square miles, an area the size of the state of Indiana. Approximately 7,300 residents live in the 11 communities scattered throughout the borough. Many of the residents rely on subsistence hunting, fishing for food, and the rivers and streams for water. The borough is aware of the 2003 report by the Division of Legislative Audit recommending the changes to the licensing procedures and oversight of guides and transporters. The borough shares the frustration expressed in the report. Over the years, there have been a significant increase in the number of transporters, outfitters, and hunters on land within the borough's boundaries. The increased noise has disturbed the wildlife and residents of various communities and have had to travel further and further to find game animals to provide food for their families. Unfortunately, not all hunters remove their trash or properly dispose of human waste, polluting the land and water. The Assembly, in response to these land use and environmental concerns, passed ordinances establishing a permitting process for transporters and providing for penalties for improper disposal of human waste and garbage. The borough supports legislation that will strengthen the oversight of guides and transporters. Such legislation should ensure that the entity that passes regulations is not controlled by guides and transporters. The entity should have significant public participation by private landowners, municipal and borough governments, like the Northwest Arctic Borough, where guides and transporters go to hunt big game. Regulations should be adopted only after significant input by affected villages, boroughs, and municipalities. They should complement and enhance, not override, local ordinances adopted to protect the environment. Boroughs should have access to information provided by guides and transporters to assist the boroughs in enforcing their ordinances. The borough is very concerned about the impact that the current unregulated hunts will have on our resources within the Northwest Arctic Borough. The current trend will lead to a huge negative impact on our resources and the ability for local residents to obtain food now and in our future. I thank you for the opportunity to express the borough's concerns. Ms. Hora will address specific recommendations to the proposed statute. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Franklin, do you have a written testimony that you could fax to us?
Yes, sir. We'll do that following. Thank you.
Okay. Do you have our fax number?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Ms. Franklin. See, no questions? Okay. We'll go on to Pete Schaefer, also with Kotzebue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll keep my remarks kind of general because I haven't had much time to go through the bill. I represent the Kotzebue Fish and Game Advisory Committee, and we're having a meeting in a week or so to address the guide bill as it stands now. So I'll just keep my remarks kind of philosophical and general because I don't think we want to get into too much detail since I think the bill is going through committee and probably get committee substituted anyway. I think that one of the aspects of the new guide bill ought to include some methodology to include the department's regional offices input into the process of how the allocation of areas to be used is going to progress, because I think consistent with the concern for adequate resource management is the management's ability to input into a significant user group, and I'm talking mostly about the transporters and probably to some degree everybody else. I think that the other issue is the lack of enforcement presence and the development of a regulatory scheme with not much enforcement ability to go along with it, simply because we've seen over the years the reduction of the Department of Public Safety Wildlife Division disappear, and now it's up to the responsibility of the blue suiters, who are under significant budget constraints as well. And the dedication of the former brown suits into their enforcement picture, I think, now is to a point where the areas that they select to enforce are based on criteria that we're probably not aware of. And we feel that GMU 23, which is game management unit in this area, is dealing with significant transport issues that involve methodology that we're concerned about. One is the ability of those transporters to saturate areas and, in fact, control drainages, which we're concerned about. And we think that there ought to be some accommodation in the framework that establishes this legislation for future regulatory development to be inclusive of that concern. And then the other issue is, in looking at the title of the bill, it basically says that it deals with House Bill 76, an act relating to big game commercial services board and the regulation of big game hunting services and transportation services and providing for an effective date. And looking at the ensuing wording of the different sections and as we go through the bill is the lack of mention of the transporters. I was wondering if that was assumed to be inclusive in the title as it is inclusive in the wording of the bill itself, or is that something that's going to have to be added later or assumed to be in there already? And with that, appreciate the opportunity to testify, and that's the end of my remarks. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. We do have a question for you, though, Mr. Schaefer. Your own outstanding representative from Kotzebue, Representative Jewell, has a question.
Not a question.
Sure.
Not a question. Hello, Todd. I know you tried to get a hold of me, and I don't have a question so much, just I'll get a hold of you after this meeting.
All right.
Well, thank you very much, Representative Jewell.
That's a first.
Thank you. Okay. Let's see. Going on, looks like we have Robert Hardy with Matt Sue. Are you with us, Mr. Hardy?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. Bill Stoltz is my representative. Representative Stoltz, excuse me, is my representative here. He and I actually went to school together. I'll keep my comments just kind of general. I do appreciate this committee and the legislature, also the Alaska Professional Hunters Association and the various departments and their divisions to address this situation that we have occurring in the field as far and also on paper as far as regulation and enforcement of the industry. One of the concerns that I have is what we've saw in the what we've seen in the Board of Game process, depending on the administration that's in place in the governor's mansion at the time, especially when it comes to allocations, access to natural resources, is we've seen, boards go from one extreme to the other and kind of all over the map. And I'm kind of concerned that we might actually see the same problem arising with this board. And in effect, what has happened is that some members of the public become disenfranchised at the board itself becomes highly politicized depending on the ideal or perspective of the administration. And so I do have some concerns in that regard as to how effective this board might actually be. But with that said, I think that there is some wiggle room there with the board to draft appropriate regulation to oversee the industry. There are a couple things in this legislation that, as it is written now that I have some concern about. Specifically speaking, the makeup of the board itself, it seems to be heavily weighed towards the industry without enough public representation on the board, those that are outside of the industry. One of the other things that I have concern about is the allowance of this board to redraft or recreate commercial use areas or the boundaries of those guide use areas. That could become a real divisive issue in the board process. Some of the other things that that I have concern about is the implementation of predator control or predation control areas and the allowance of this board to accommodate the industry to have preferential or better access to the elimination of large predators. One of the other things that I do have concern about is the reporting requirement for suspected violations committed by members of the industry. I think that the reporting requirement that's currently written into the board is, or written into the legislation, is far too lenient. I would like to see a tighter time frame on that. With that said, I want the committee to be aware that as the legislation is written, it specifically doesn't decrease or it doesn't restrict the expansion of the industry, nor does it enhance reasonable opportunities for subsistence users or other Alaskans. And in light that the McDowell decision stipulates that all Alaskans are subsistence users, the industry itself is highly competitive opposite other Alaskans. And I don't know if this is the place to address something like this, but I've been trying to think of ways that the industry could contribute more towards the development, conservation and development of our natural resources as provided for under Article 8. And what I've come up with was an idea to levy trophy fees per individual guide for the species, number of animals that the individual clients take. And I think that a trophy fee appropriate comparable to the price of a non-resident big game tag per species would be appropriate for the operator, and kind of give them more of an ownership. The industry has always prided itself in paying its own way, and I think that this would make them more of a shareholder in the resource and also contribute more towards the conservation of our natural resources, our big game populations. With that said, I do thank the committee for this time that they've allowed me to express my views, and I look forward to seeing how this bill develops over the course of this legislature. Thank you.
Thank you. See, no questions. Thank you for your testimony. Okay, we'll go back to the north, the Great Northwest, and Cynthia Hora.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I am in Anchorage.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
For the record, my name is Cynthia Hora. I'm an attorney with Landy Bennett Blumstein, and we represent the Northwest Arctic Borough.
All right.
Kim Franklin gave you a lot of, you know, kind of an overview of the concerns that the borough has with transporters and guides, and I'm here to make substantive suggestions to the text of the bill.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Yep. The Northwest Arctic Borough and I believe Mr. Hardy expressed concern about the composition of the board. When the board was first enacted and established in 1973, it was a 7-member board, and it was said that no more than 3 could be guides or transporters, so that the majority would not be involved in the industry, and the borough supports that concept. It's my understanding that there will be an amendment proposed that would make the board membership such that there would be 4 members from the industry and 5 not from the industry, and the borough would support that amendment with 2 reservations. First, I believe it's going to add in, say, 2 public members. The borough would like to also have that it be 2 public members who do not hold a license issued under this chapter. And if you can, that kind of tracks the language for the private landholders and would ensure that there would only be, you know, 4 guides and transporters on the board. Another requirement that we believe should be added is the member should have resided in the state for at least 10 years and have knowledge about the game resources of the state. These were requirements for the public members of the original board, and we believe that that is an admirable qualification that should be added to this bill. I'm going to proceed now to Section 5, which involves the board's authority to adopt regulations. And this comes more from my significant experience arguing issues of statutory construction before all levels of the state and federal courts. And this section deals with adoption of regulations. And what I would propose is to have the some sections from page 17 and page 19, which refer to the board's ability to amend the, if you look on page, let's see, uh, 17, it's the section 08.54.750, and it talks about, it's in that section, but it's not, actually, I'm sorry, it's on page 18. It talks about the guide use areas, means the geographic area of the state, and it talks about that the outfitter use area maps may be amended by the board as the board considers necessary. And I'd recommend putting that language in with Section 5 to say that's, you know, because you're going to specify when, what types of regulations can be adopted rather than sticking it in another section. Similarly, with Section 30, subsection G, the last sentence says the board may establish transport use areas and adopt regulations to implement this section, subsection, as the board considers necessary. I'd also suggest moving that to the board's authority to adopt regulations. So if it ever gets challenged, you know, all the authority to adopt regulations is in the same place. Next, I'd like to address Section 6. The legislative audit was concerned with basically game management and consumer protection. The Northwest Arctic Borough is also concerned with land use and environmental aspects. As Ms. Franklin said, you know, the borough has adopted a, you know, waste ordinance, and we would like to see an amendment to Section 6, which would include violations of state, federal, and local ordinances involving environmental violations committed during the hunt. With respect to Section 8, just a minor comment. In number 2, where we talk about registered guide outfitters having practical field experience, we'd like to add in Alaska. Moving on to Section 25. Which deals with the unlawful practices. Subsection 4 talks about it being unlawful for a person who holds a license to knowingly remain on private, state, or federal. We'd ask that you add borough land, as the Northwest Borough has a significant amount of land in which hunting occurs. Similarly, on Section 35, where you talk about requiring permission, we'd ask that the borough also be listed in the federal, state, municipal, or borough on private land. And in addition to requiring permission, we would recommend that the statute require some sort of proof of permission at the initial application phase and not later on down the road after a trespass may already have occurred. With respect to Section 31 and access to, my understanding is there'll be an amendment to add the word political subdivision, and the borough supports that amendment. Finally, the Northwest Borough has, you know, this basically came on their radar screen within the last couple of days, and I've, you know, spent some time looking at it. I've talked to Representative Samuels Aide Henry And there may be a couple of other minor fine-tuning aspects that the borough may suggest. One of the concerns that I had is that the term guide outfitter is not defined. The term guide is defined and the term outfit is defined, but they appear to be internally inconsistent in the sense that the guide has to be out in the field and an outfit, in order to outfit, it's someone who is not out in the field. So you can't be there and not be there. And my understanding is one of the problems with this whole area of regulation is, you know, it's who's a transporter, who's a outfitter, who's a guide, and I would like to see the definitions tightened up now rather than later. And I've offered to work with Representative Samuel's staff, and I'll work with Representative Jewell's staff as well in terms of trying to fine-tune some of those definitions.
Mr. Chairman?
Does that conclude your testimony?
Yes, it does.
Okay, we do have a question for you, Representative Watson.
Okay.
Well, it's actually generic. Did I hear in that there's amendments going to be proposed to the bill?
Yes, Representative Watson. We have two amendments before us.
That incorporate her testimony?
I believe some of the amendments do encompass some of her testimony, yes.
Mr. Chairman, some of the regulatory issues I hear being raised, do we need to invite the EC back in here? They were sitting here a while ago. I just want to make sure we cover all the scopes.
Oh, we'll let the sponsor here talk to some of the comments and amendments as we get to the Okay, thank you, Cynthia, for your testimony. And let's see, I have still Paul Johnson as possibly wanting to testify or for questions. Okay, come on up, please.
Is that Paul Joslin, you said?
Johnson. Yeah, my name is Paul Johnson. I've been a guide for over 30 years in the Southeast and have worked on this since it was put into a combined legislative task force years ago. And this has been mulled over and worked over, and one thing I've come to determination of, there's nothing that's going to be perfect on this, and we'll be coming back to you as the years go by. At this point in time, I think we're trying to put a set of wheels on this car and get it rolling. I think we can hammer this out. This has been on our radar screen as a big dot for a long time, and this bill needs to move forward. We've been 10 years without it, and then during that time, I could sit here all day and tell you the things that have come down. So with that, I just want to mention that going back in time from the first days of the first guide board, then to the commercial services board, as far as membership goes, we have found that the private landholder people have been very responsive and have been interested in being involved in this industry and have shown up and been there, and I think would do a great job. So I think one of the amendments coming up of keeping it at 7 members, basically for cost reasons. We used to have 9 members on this board, and obviously it's a pays away board, and so to keep costs down and keep costs reasonable to the industry as a whole, keeping a 7 member board but making some changes within those 7 members and having 2 private landholders and eliminating the public member, which I know makes some people nervous, but the reality is that would work. I can't urge you enough we can all come around and poke at different things this bill. I can. I think any one of us could. And it's not perfect. It's not going to be perfect no matter how much you try to kick it around the block. We need to move it along. We need to have it and start someplace and put wheels under this car.
Very good. We have a question for you, Erickson Stokes.
Thank you, Chairman Ryan, Ms. Johnson. I'm sure you're glad that this has gotten this far in the House and get a chance to testify for our last committee. And that's I appreciate all the work you've put in over the years. And just to clarify, this board will pay for itself, and I assume the guides through your fees will pay the operating costs of the boards.
Right. The guides are going to pick up most of the cost, always have. Transporters are going to pick up some of the cost. One of the things I think the state needs to realize is that when we had prior boards, when there was a meeting, usually there was 2 meetings a year, there was one-stop shopping because you had DEC showed up at these meetings, DNR, who testified, showed up at these meetings,
instead of having every individual guide or transporter going in and talking to these different agencies and dealing with, that keep these guys on the phone or in their office all day long answering questions on the same thing, it was one-stop shopping. So when the guides and the transporters and people went to these meetings, they dealt with the DNR and their issues there, the Park Service with their issues there, the Forest Service with their issues there, and we moved forward and kept a cohesive deal. And one thing in industry, when you have each agency out there on their own or promoting regulations and doing different things without having coming to something that the industry has a feel for, it gets scattered. And then there's no enforcement on top of that. So public safety, we had public safety came to every one of our meetings and was there and knew where the hotspots were, communicated with the guides and the transporter, knew where the problems were, and there was collaboration as far as that goes. So it actually is going to save, without question, it's going to save the state money if you create this board as far as your administrative costs within your own agencies.
Mr. Chair, can I clarify? And you probably spoke with clarity, and I probably wasn't listening attentively. And so you favor the 7 and the 9 member, right?
Yeah, I favor a 7 member board, and it gets down to I'm not going to, break my pick over this by any stretch of the imagination. This board's more important than to break my pick over. But obviously, a 7 member board, since the license fees pays for it, a 7 member board is more generally going to be more efficient, number one, but number two is going to be. A lot more cost-effective, and I think would be a more effective. I agree wholeheartedly that we started this whole process out last year when it passed the Senate with two private landholder members, one transporter, two guides, one game board member, and a public member. So if we went back to two private landholders, which are basically on disciplinary actions, are going to be a public member, would act in that role, I support that 100%.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for your testimony today. Is there anyone else in the audience who wanted to testify on this bill, House Bill 36? Is there anyone online that I have overlooked or missed? Okay, seeing none.
No, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I just, the enforcement folks, I guess I'd like to hear their take on this bill. And there was a section I was looking at on the, I just want to understand, get a little bit of grasp on the fines and the penalties. If I think one of the former brown shirts is online.
Okay, yeah, if we could just hold off for just a second on that. We do have a. Major Howard Starboard with the Alaska State Troopers, and Rick Urin is also in the audience for questions. I just want to make sure that if there's anyone else left to testify, that we get to them first.
Yes, sir.
And I don't see any, so I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. Rest of the foster.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that I have one constituent in my area that faxed in his concerns.
Okay.
And that these were, as a matter of record, so these numbers filed here as an
email. Okay, good. Thank you, Representative Foster, for bringing that to attention. Yes, we do have a testimony in written form here for us. I don't believe he wanted to testify, though. Okay. Very good. So we're going to go ahead and close the public testimony on this bill and bring the sponsor back up. He's here. And Sponsor Samuels, you've heard some of the testimony, some of the concerns. Do you have any additional comments before we open this up to questions?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, the biggest concern that I just heard, the greatest concern of mine that I just heard is a couple of the guides mentioned exclusive use areas, and I'm sure some of them really like them and some of them that don't have them really don't like them. This bill has absolutely nothing to do with that. They're not constitutional. All this bill does is it takes the off-licensing duties and moves it to a board so you have some expertise on the industry in general, some expertise, and there will be conflicts in there. We tried to, I know that Representative Jewell is going to have an amendment in here in the makeup of the board perhaps. There are conflicts inherent between the transporters and the guides, and we tried to address that, between the landowners and the transporters and the guides, and we tried to address that. But absent the board, most people that just testified didn't think we went far enough. They want us to fix the problems that exist. This bill simply creates the boards so that you have a forum to look at the problems that are out there. That's all this bill does. So, and as far as on the radar screen, I heard testimony that on the radar screen, the exact wording of this bill passed the Senate last year and has been in the hopper. It has been through a committee process already. It has been all through last year for 2 years, so a whole lot of work has gone into this. But all it does is set up the framework. It takes it from off licensing, and it sets up the board, so the board can address something for the industry. But generally speaking, there's some nibbling around the edges on other things here, but generally speaking, that's where the bill is going. And if the committee so chooses to move the bill out, I can certainly work with various people. We're not going to be willing to go a whole lot further on fixing the problems that some of the guides brought up or some of the bro people brought up until we get the framework set up so that we have some way to have the input from both the customers and all of the users to come in there. And that's generally what we're trying to do. So with that, I know Representative Stoltz has some questions for law enforcement, and I know Representative Jewell had some amendments. So.
Okay, thank you, Representative Samuels. Any questions for Representative Samuels before we go to Major Starbuck?
Okay, seeing none. Representative Stoltz, we get a question.
Well, first, I guess Mr. Chairman, we should establish whether or not the fellow from Alaska State Troopers online, so we don't have to.
Yes, I mentioned that he was available for questions. I'm assuming he's still online. Yes,
okay. Mr. Chairman, in Section 6, section on some of the things that can get your license pulled. It said fine more than $1,000 in the previous 12 months. Is that an aggregate total, and what type of offenses are those? Littering can have a $1,000 fine. Is that a serious enough offense? Not something I condone, but to have somebody's license pulled. I just want to pursue that and make sure we're not making this stricter than we might want to. I guess maybe the troopers can address that, or the sponsor, whoever.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Yes, for the record, this is Major Howard Starwood. I am the administrative commander for the Alaska State Troopers. Previously, I was the commander for the then Fish and Wildlife Protection converted to the Alaska Bureau of Wildlife Enforcement. Have since taken a promotion and moved up. I still am very familiar with this bill, having worked on the previous bill and having spent a considerable amount of time working with law, with the industry, and having played a major role in a lot of these more related to enforcement and not the provisions of the bill related to whether there's a board or the makeup of the board. Specifically to Section 6, we added, and there was earlier testimony reference federal, we added the federal section within there, and we didn't limit it to within Alaska, although there was discussions on that, simply because there are guides that come up from south who have extensive records who we have no authority to keep them from being a guide here, or as was testified to, the Lacey Act violation where they break a state law, a minor state law here, but by crossing the state line, they've violated the Lacey felony, and so they end up committing a felony, and still there's no provision. So we added that, and we didn't restrict it to within Alaska. Going on to the actual tiered system, the fine, the way it reads, the fine is that if a person is convicted of a violation of the law or regulation currently, and they are fined more than $1,000, and it could be not a single event but an aggregate for hunting, guiding, or regulation, if they're fined more than $1,000, and that's including the suspended amount, and or they are imprisoned and sent to jail, get a jail sentence of 5 days, they, at this point, currently, are not allowed to renew their license. They can't renew for 5 years. So what we've done by doing this tiered system, we've actually taken away and made it, we think it's much more reasonable in that within the past 5 years, you still, if you're doing something serious enough for a hunting, guiding, or transportation service statute or regulation, for 5 days within the past five years, we think that that's still serious enough, and the courts generally don't send somebody to jail for a guiding, hunting, or transportation violation unless it's fairly serious. So we left that part, but we changed it so that $1,000, if you find more than $1,000, instead of the 5 years, within the 12 months, it would be for 1 year. So yes, it is in aggregate. You could have a $500 hunting violation this month. 11 months from now, have another $500 hunting. You would not be able to renew until that 12-month period extended, much like your point system for the driving license and or the point system we have for the CFPC permits. So that over $1,000 for 12 months and then tiered up to $3,000 for the 36 and $5,000 for the 60 months, all based on the fact that none of those had changed since the inception of the original statutes. The $1,000 in 5 years was the original portion. So it's keeping up with the times, and it's also making that much more reasonable, we think. We have a lot of cases where guides are fined just under $1,000 purposely by the court on something really serious, and they'll lose a significant piece of equipment or something simply because the livelihood would be lost for 5 years. I hope that answers the question.
Mr. Chairman, if maybe the sponsor can, it's his bill, and maybe he might address his intent. And
yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, you spread it out where it used to read it was $1,000 for 5 years and you were done. So in your example of a littering violation, which it's got to be a hunting violation, but a minor violation, and you're done for 5 years, and you're older, this does spread it out a little bit. So if you're a repeat offender, you're going to get busted. But if not, it's
Mr. Chairman, on that point, does it actually have to be a hunting violation? Could it be
right here,
how you conduct your camp and some non? How specific or narrow is hunting violation?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, a violation of a state or federal hunting, guiding, or transportation services statute regulation. We haven't changed that at all. We added federal, is all that the bill has done. Other than that, the law is the same. The fine structure spread out. So we watered it down for the early violation and we beefed it up later, but we didn't change any definitions for what a violation of a state hunting, guiding, or transportation service statute or regulation was. Whatever it was yesterday would be the same as tomorrow.
Oh. Right. Mr. Chairman, I don't want to condone bad behavior, but I just we're talking about livelihoods, and I just want to make sure. I'm always worried about when I'm saying yes or no and pushing buttons about connectivity of how these real decisions affect real life, and that's what I want to make sure, somebody's livelihood, and it's a consumer protection bill. I appreciate that aim, but I just want to make sure that, and it sounds like the enforcement and how the court systems have handled it, it's been sensitive, but I'm not sure it always is that way. And $1,000 worth of fines for regulations, I don't know what all of them are, whether it's... maybe the future amendments on political subdivisions, that, and I don't know how that would impact it. And I just want to have a comfort level in trying to, we're trying to crack this nut. I just want to make sure we do it right, and I don't know if it's achievable or not, but this is the first time I've ever heard the bill in a committee, despite some people's opinions of what I have in this bill or not.
Go ahead. First thing, through the chair, I said we didn't change any of the definitions. We changed the fine structure a little bit. And the $1,000, we actually made it easier to keep your license.
Right.
With a small fine.
Certainly for the record, your intent is not to bust somebody for littering, right? It's hunting.
No, that is not the intent of the...
Okay, good.
Mr. Chairman, I know you it was your desire to close the testimony at... we've been waiting a long time to have this hearing in this committee, a couple of years, and Henry used to have hair when he started leaving. So,
But if there's anybody from the industry, that can maybe come up with some examples that might be problem. I don't know who's like the guy in front.
Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson, go ahead. You've heard Representative Stoltz.
Yes, sir. I have. And all due respect to Howard Starbird, there, Major Howard Starbird. But I don't want to slow this bill down either. But $1,000 anymore on a stubbing your toe, which it can be, stubbing your toe, if it was raised to two, it does two things. One is that it could be, should be a quick amendment. One is that, as Major Starbird brought up, is the courts have been holding the fines to $999 instead of making them, $1,900, because they don't want somebody's license pulled. So that's been the downside, their side of that piece of bacon. Whenever you slice a piece of bacon, there's two sides. But as time has gone along, some of these, somebody being out there without a license, or even if you're not involved in the guiding activity, it's a game law. And we had an incident in Sitka a couple of years ago where a guy didn't write down the king salmon in the back of his licenses, and he wasn't renewed because his fine was a little over $1,000. So those situations do occur. I appreciate Mr. Stoltz's concern, but I certainly don't want to hold this bill up either. But raising it a little bit's not going to hurt anything.
So not to revisit an issue that Representative Weinrock and I discussed, I mean, if you took your boat out without a decal on it five times, that would...
I forgot about that. Yes.
in a remote area, that's, I don't know, it's...
Nothing changed in the bill. Nothing changed in the bill.
Representative Joel, do you have a question?
Yeah, I've got a question on the fiscal note from Hawk Licensing.
Okay. Mr. Rick, you're in. Three syllables. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rick Urien. I'm the director of the Division of the Bad Division of Occupational Licensing that I heard earlier.
All right. Question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Here, you make an assumption about the composition. And it sure shrunk the size of the state of Alaska as I know it. Two members from Southeast, two members from Anchorage, two members from Kodiak, and one from Fairbanks. How did you arrive at those assumptions when much of the hunting activity comes from a large part of the other part of the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, in some circles, it's called a WAG. I have people that make fiscal notes that their years of experience in government have determined how they do it, and I didn't make that, so that's something that's done from 20-some years of experience of writing this thing.
I just want to make sure that the rest of Alaska does not get lost in this, and that interests, as the board gets appointed, are taken care of from all parts of Alaska and not just a small portion of it.
I'm sure the person that wrote that didn't mean to slight any segment of the state. It was that they were guessing whether they were going to come from it.
Okay, just as long as, I don't want this to be cast in stone. Because it assumes what the governor's going to do. And I know we're doing it for the purposes of trying to figure out what the costs are. And the way I look at this, just don't want the wrong implied message.
Representative Sandals, did you want to comment?
Yeah, just very briefly. I'm going to assume the distance between Ketchikan and Anchorage for a meeting is roughly the same as the distance between Bear or Kotzebue and Anchorage, and the airfare is roughly the same. The fiscal note they ran a model and did it there. I'm assuming that this
could be. I hope that's the case. I just don't want the rest, as appointments get made, to be stuck to this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Joy.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, while I'm here, I know you closed the public testimony, but I would like to have this opportunity to set the record straight from what I heard here earlier. I've been the Director of Occupational Licensing for 2 years now, and I don't know what happened in this division before I got here, but I can tell you what's happened since I've been here, and I can tell you that we've aggressively tried to change the laws before you. We have, in fact, we're the only ones that have made substantial amendments to the bill before you, to the Division of Occupational Licensing, from people who've worked with guys for years and years and years. We're the ones that submitted amendments to this bill a year ago. No one else. Division of Occupational Licensing. So for anyone to suggest that we haven't tried to change this law is absolutely false. We've tried aggressively to change it, because I can tell you that we've received so many complaints over the years since I've been here, and we can do nothing about it because the law doesn't allow us to do anything about it. It's not because we don't want to do anything about it. The law doesn't allow us.
Okay. Thank you. I'm not sure if that was... I guess you're just clearing up a concern that was brought up earlier. Actually, we do have some other questions on the fiscal note. So once you stay put, Ripson, Wyra, did you have a question?
Mr. Urien, the folks that are appointed to this board, are they going to be able to make decisions? If they're guides, are they going to be able to, in their appointed board, are they going to be able to make decisions without running afoul of the Ethics Act and Conflict of Interest Act?
Mr. Chair, I would hope so. That would certainly, I think that's the sponsor's intention.
Here's my concern is we have a boards rife with people that are appointed for those boards, like the Board of Game, Board of Fish, potentially this board, that are appointed because of their expertise in investment in the very subject of matter that they're deliberating on, and many of times they're prohibited from deliberating or even voting because of the law. Does there need to be something in this to make it specific so that they can deliberate and vote, or is that already part of this bill?
It would be the same as any other board of commission, but it's different with the board of fish and the board of game, where they're allocating the resource. It's simply not going to happen here. So it's not, it's a little apples and oranges. The board of fish is obviously problematic, but we tried to set this board up. The inherent conflict between the transporters and the guides, so we evened out the number of transporters and guides. When you look at the big picture of it, and there are some other concerns Representative Jewell kind of addresses in his amendment, but that's the inherent conflict within the industry, between the guides and the transporters. So we tried to balance as we went down the road to make sure that everybody, all of the user groups are represented, so the MCs at the table as the decision, but they're not going to be allocation decisions. It's not like a board of fish type board.
That's the wire scratching your heads.
No, that's fine.
Okay. Okay, I think what we're going to do, Rex and Sam, is 3:30, and I'm going to start losing some members here soon. We have nothing on the slate for tomorrow. I'd like to just hold this over until tomorrow, take up Representative Jewell's amendments. I know Representative Chenault and myself have some questions about fiscal note. Maybe we can work with you in the interim. And get some of these worked out before we come back tomorrow. But I would anticipate, unless there's some more amendments that I'm not seeing, that we should be able to take this up first thing and get it kicked out relatively quickly. So, is there anything else to come? Yes, Rashid.
Yeah, just one quick question. I didn't quite understand. Like, if you're out there and a guy makes a mess, like littering, is he paying more than somebody else just for the city?
I think it, through the chair, I think it would be a question for the trooper, but I would think not. It's not going to. Common sense sometimes doesn't enter the building very often, but if it's not a hunting violation, wanton waste if you're leaving the meat behind, or shooting something in a season or too small, something like that, that's not going to be a hunting violation. So that is my assumption on that, but I can check with the troopers.
But the fine wouldn't be any different.
What's that?
If you were just a citizen.
No, but if the fine within here, as far as losing your license, if it's not a fine for a hunting violation, then it doesn't count against you.
Resident Foster, would you like the troopers to address that?
Well, you know, I ran the air service for 20 years. We used to fly hunters all the time, local hunters, hunters from outside. We never left a mess. But I'll tell you what, my neighbors and the people I know and my friends sure left big messes because I've been all over the country. You know, I want to know if they're going to get fined $1,000. Sure, they're just a poor outsider, you know?
Yeah.
And you being in an air taxi, you know, we used to haul, it was daily, we'd haul a seal from Shishmaref to Nome from a guy to his grandma. I mean, we transported a lot of meat, but I never had no license. Does that fit under there?
Through
I mean,
chair.
Caribou meat, sheepfish, you name it. We've
through the chair.
And these were subsistence hunters, but you know, I don't want to stick air taxis in Sparrow here.
Through the chair, I was extremely cognizant. that's another one. There are several major issues. The conflict between transporters and guides is a major issue, mostly where yourself and Dr. Jewell are from, or a little bit where I grew up down on the peninsula. But you don't want to, and we got the definitions in here, throw the 135 operator. So we did not change, the definitions within the bill of a transporter. And if you don't go out and advertise and have a substantial part of your income, so if you fly up to a village in the interior somewhere and you set up shop and all you do is take hunters from this base camp where you have all the supplies and you take them out to hunt little hunting camps and dropping them off, if that's what you do, then you're included. If you're a 135 operator and you're just charging somebody A to B per pound per head going down there, you're excluded by definition. So we worked very hard at making sure the 135 operators are not included in here at all.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Representative Samuels. And Representative Samuels, I'll leave it up to you as to who you want here tomorrow. I think, Rick, you should probably be here for sure. And maybe the troopers, yeah.
We'll make your answer.
And I have another question for you. Can you come back tomorrow?
Yeah,
he'll be
in 15 minutes.
So the Calcutta bill was postponed, and the sponsor asked to hold it over. So for tomorrow, this will be the only item that works. With that, we're adjourned.
Hey,
Ralph.